Thank you. So my name is Taylor Brown. I'm the principal lead program manager for Windows containers. Basically, anything that's a server container coming out of Windows kind of falls under my area. So we've been involved with the Docker team for over 2 years now. It actually started when we flew down to meet with them, with our goal being, hey, maybe they can make the Docker CLI work with like these container APIs that we were thinking about building. And sitting in a room with Solomon where he kind of said, hey, you know, this is all open source. You can just go change the code yourself. And I was like, huh, well, what is that going to mean to us? And fast forward to now, and we've really embraced the Docker community, and it's actually been a great ride. We've built a lot of fun stuff and a lot of changes. You see John Howard in the audience, a lot of PRs for to make Docker work. And so with that, I actually want to introduce John Starks. He's been one of the principal architects behind all of our container technologies. And he's going to tell you, take you through a deep dive into how all this works, what all we did, what does and doesn't work.
Thanks, Taylor. So Taylor's mostly right that we're going to do a dive through things. Probably kind of a shallow dive, because there's a lot of differences between Windows and Linux, and a lot of changes we had to kind of make to Windows and to Docker and to really make containers work the way that everybody expects. And so I'm going to go through a lot of different things pretty quickly. And if you have questions, we'll have some time at the end, or you can find me in the Microsoft booth tomorrow morning, and we can go into more detail in any specific area. But basically what I want to cover is kind of what's the basic architecture that we have with Docker and Windows, and then go into a few of the kind of kernel-level concepts that we had to add to Windows to make containers work, some of the things that are analogous to namespaces and C groups and things like that in Linux. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about Hyper-V containers, where we've taken Hyper-V, which is our virtualization platform, and kind of combined it with containers to build something new. So first, just what's the basic architectures here? So what is Docker on Windows? So there's kind of a terminology thing here, because there's also Docker for Windows, which is the development platform that I think was talked about this morning. And this is really the Docker engine on Windows. So we've actually taken the Docker engine, Dockerd, and ported it to run on Windows. It's not a fork. It's part of the GitHub. It's in master and Docker. As Taylor mentioned, John Howard's a maintainer on the Docker engine and has done an awful lot of our porting to Windows. And that means that you know, we get the same API, the same remote API, the same tools work on top, Compose, Swarm, anything that talks the Docker remote API just automatically works with the Docker on Windows. But what this required is a lot of new features in Windows itself, because we didn't previously have all the namespace support, C group-like support, things like that. And so this does require new versions of Windows to run. And so we've got Windows Server 2016 coming out this year, and the latest Windows 10 Insider builds have these features in them and allow this to work. But specifically, this is Windows Server containers. So we're not running. This is not Ubuntu running on Windows. That's a different project. This is actually running Windows applications, Win32 applications, containerized. And it is available to try now. So this URL here, aka.ms/containers, has all the information you need to try this out, either by setting up an Azure VM, downloading a VM, or running on a Windows 10 client machine. OK, so let's just start with a quick demo of this working. So here I have, this is a Hyper-V VM running a latest build of Server 2016. And here I've got Dockerd running, the Docker engine. Normally this could run as a service in Windows, but here I'm just running it from the command line so we can see the output from from the logs more easily. So here I'm just going to, you know, I can say Docker images. Here I've got a few different images. I'm just going to run this demo real quick. And there we go. Great. So that's kind of boring, but you can see it runs kind of the same way that Docker does on Linux. It's identical, except you can see I'm running CMD instead of Bash or whatever. So how do we do this? Well, again, as I said, we've had to add new system level capabilities into Windows, new kernel concepts. I keep saying namespaces because that's what the term that everybody uses with Linux. We don't actually call it that internally, but I'll probably continue to use that term. Resource controls, so kind of C groups equivalents, so we can constrain the behavior of each container so it doesn't use all the resources in the system. We've had to develop a new union file system-like thing. The other thing we had to do is really adapt Docker itself to Windows. And this kind of came in a few different forms. In some cases, it was just fixing Linuxisms. You know, okay, well, Docker assumed you could fork. We can't fork in Windows. You know, Docker assumed that the console behaved a certain way. We had to do some work there. And then bigger things, like rethinking some of the architecture on how containers are launched, or specifically just replacing the libnetwork plugin for Linux with one for Windows or the graph driver. But the other big thing is really adapting Windows to Docker. And this has been, I think, a really great learning experience for the Windows team, because initially we kind of set out and said, we're going to build containers and we're going to build it our way. And as we tried to integrate with Docker, we said, well, actually, our way isn't right. And so we got a lot of constant feedback from seeing how Docker did things, seeing what worked and what didn't. And we really were able to do a much more iterative development process because of that. So that's been, I think, a great success. So briefly, let's just look at what's the kind of high-level architecture. What are the differences between Linux and Windows? So here's kind of a, don't look too closely at the details here. You know, if you think about kind of the stack, you've got your various Docker clients on top, the things that talk to the Docker engine. Then the Docker engine's got the REST interface on top, and it's got some plugin capabilities at the bottom. You've got libcontainerd, which talks to containerd and runs, which uses runc to launch containers. And then you've got kind of the kernel level functionality at the bottom here. So how's this different for Windows? Let's just, you know, if we kind of flip back and forth, not much, right? Not much difference. The big thing you'll see is that containerd and runc aren't on here. And so why is that? What did we do instead? So there's something called compute service there instead at the operating system level. What is that? Well, the idea behind the compute service is some of this low level functionality I'm going to talk about later, the namespaces, things like that. It's really not something we're prepared to make a public interface yet. Maybe someday, but we're kind of iterating so quickly that it would be difficult for us to support kind of our lowest level APIs. So the compute service, the idea here is let's build something a little higher level as our public interface to containers from Windows. And you can think of this as kind of like containerd, if you're familiar with it, where it's a service that manages running containers, but not containers you've created and haven't started yet or anything like that. It doesn't keep any state for containers. It just is able to launch containers, keep track of them that they're running, manage a little bit around restart and things like that, and really abstracts those low-level capabilities that the kernel provides. And the nice thing about this is we can kind of iterate there within Windows on those low-level capabilities without changing that interface that Docker uses. And the other nice thing is that this is something that anybody can plug into. Docker Engine is the main consumer right now, but we have language bindings for C# as well, and then the Go stuff that Docker uses. So, you know, check those out if you kind of want to see the little bit medium-level interface into our container technology. Okay, but that's kind of the less interesting stuff. That's the high-level stuff. So let's get a little bit into what's going on underneath that container service. What did we do in the kernel to actually support containers? Well, here's another look at the architecture. You can see that at the bottom here, we've got a shared kernel, just like in Linux. On the left, we've got kind of the host user mode. So this is just your, you know, whatever's running in Windows. There's a bunch of system processes. There's a few processes that are have to do with Docker. And on the right side, we've got, just in this example, two Windows Server containers running. And I think the most interesting thing here is, so these guys have their own, you know, just like in Linux, it's kind of like their own view of the system as their own user mode, in a sense. But I think what's interesting here is we see system processes and application processes. What's going on there? Like, you know, in Linux, when you start a container, it's just got one process in it. It's the one you ran, right? In Windows, it's a little bit different. So the thing you have to remember about Windows is that, first of all, it's always been developed as a highly integrated system where, you know, Microsoft really controls the public interfaces via DLLs. We provide kernel32.dll and all these DLLs that you call into to, you know, do I/O, interact with the operating system, whatever. But specifically, these aren't syscalls. We don't document our syscalls, the stuff that actually is the user mode kernel mode boundary. The other thing is we have, like I said, it's a highly integrated system. So as a result, there ended up being a lot of interdependencies in Windows between this DLL is calling that DLL, which is calling into this system service. And so there's kind of an expectation in Windows that all these DLLs are there, and all these and many services are there, too. Even to do kind of basic things like DNS queries, there's got to be a service running. So as a result of all this, it's not really realistic to say, well, I just want to run a single process in isolation in a container, because it relies on all these other user mode things that are out there. And so in addition, because of all the DLLs, we can't really just have a very, very small container image that just has your single statically linked binary. We really have to pull in more of the Windows stuff. So what that means is when we start a container in Windows, even though you say, oh, I just want to launch it with this one process, you know, my web server or whatever, we actually start our equivalent of the init process behind the scenes. So ours is called SMSS, and that thing's going to start up and launch a bunch of system services that you just kind of have to deal with the fact that they're there. And then we'll launch your process once those are started. So as I was saying, this means that there's really no way you can say from scratch in a Docker file for Windows, because you wouldn't be able to provide all the base functionality that really has to be there for Windows to work. So what are these base images that we distribute? Well, so they are distributed by Microsoft. We've got two available. There's Windows Server Core, and there's Nano Server. So what's the difference there? So Windows Server Core is basically we took Windows Server and we made it into a container image, the existing kind of full Windows Server that you might be used to. This thing's got high-level compatibility. .NET 4.5 apps work great on it, but it is huge. I mean, I don't know if you can see in the picture, it says 9.3 gigs. That's huge, right? But you get full compatibility. Well, almost full compatibility with kind of your existing apps. It's very easy to take an existing Windows app and get it running in the Windows Server Core image. Nano Server is where we want to go, I think. It's much smaller. In this picture, it says 810 megs. I think it's down to 600 or something right now, in, at least on my machine. I don't know. And but the API surface is much smaller, because if you think about all those interdependencies I was talking about, well, we just got rid of a bunch of them, right? We got rid of the graphical, you know, the graphics stack. We got rid of, you know, the fax server or whatever is in Windows Server. I'm not kidding. So it really is smaller, and I'm hoping that we can get it smaller still. But the result is that, you know, some of your existing applications are just not going to work. You know, we had some struggles even getting Docker to run on Nano Server at times, you know, because Go used some new functionality that we broke and all this stuff. So it's more work to kind of get your workloads down to that size, but the dividends are huge, I think, in that being able you can use a smaller, this much smaller, faster startup, less memory hoggish image. So how do you get these things? Well, if you remember if you've tried this stuff, you know that it's kind of a pain to get these things. You have to like download them separately and use some PowerShell script or whatever. We're very close to having Docker pool working on these. Even though that the download will actually come from the Microsoft server, we've actually integrated things to the point that we'll be able to just say Docker pool, and it'll pull it down just like on Linux. And you won't have to think about it again. OK, let's see these guys running. So if we come back here again, I'm going to start up two container images, one with Nano server, and then one with Windows Server Core. And you can see the second one took a little longer to start up. And if I run PowerShell git service here, look at all these services. Now, these aren't all running, don't worry. A lot of them are stopped. But they're there, right? That's kind of weird. So if you look at git service in Nano server, the list is still a little longer than I like, but more respectable, I think. But this kind of gives you an idea of, you know, some of the challenges we've had in trying to get Windows, which is, again, developed as this integrated operating system, scaled back to the point that it really can be, that we really can use it effectively for containers. The other thing I wanted to show here in this demo real quick is just, okay, well, what happened? We launched both of these containers, and if I say git process within the Nano server container, let's say, these are the processes that are running. So the only one I asked to be run was the CMD, but we had to start up a bunch of other stuff. Here's PowerShell because I just launched it, of course. If we go to Task Manager on the host, we can actually see these guys running. So the C exec service, each of these are running in containers, and each of the, you know, one each for the two containers. If we go, we can find SMSS. There's the two additional SMSSs, if you recall, that's like the init process for Windows. And so if I exit these guys, you know, those go away. There's now only one SMSS. And so I guess I'm really trying to show you here, we do have the shared kernel. You can see all the container processes on the outside, just like in Linux. But from within the container, you can only see the processes that it launched. OK, so now let's go a little bit deeper still. Let's look at the namespaces I talked about. So what does that mean? Well, in Windows, we don't talk about namespaces as we don't use that term a lot because we don't really, how to put it? We didn't really develop this as, OK, well, we can have a bunch of different namespaces that are all kind of opt-in or opt-out. Instead, we have kind of this central aggregation point, which we call a silo, which kind of ties all the different namespace things together. And a silo is an extension, if you're familiar with the Windows kernel or with some of the lower level 132 APIs, we already had something called a job object in Windows that represents kind of a set of processes that you can assign resource controls to, some limited set of resource controls. We've extended that here to also be able, you can turn a job object into a silo, and then it will have essentially its own set of process namespace, session namespace, its own object namespace, file system networking. All this stuff is now isolated to be per silo. And so internally, we use the term silo a lot instead of container to refer to kind of the lower level part of a Windows Server container. We've also extended this stuff with additional resource controls to be able to do more control of storage costs, for example, or better control over memory use of the of each container. So I think probably you understand the process namespace stuff. Okay, I already showed each container has its own process table. We'll talk a little bit about the file system, but I think maybe the most interesting one is the object namespace to me. Because this is something I think not everybody realizes if they just use Windows as a user or even as a developer, is that Windows actually has a root, a slash, just like Linux. And it's just that it's invisible to users. So everybody thinks, okay, we've got drive letters, we've got C drive, D drive, and that's kind of the root of everything. But that's actually not true. At the NT level, there is a slash in all the devices kind of and other kernel objects live in that namespace. And so when you say C:\Windows, that actually gets mapped in user mode before it calls down to the kernel. That gets mapped to not quite true, but it gets mapped to slash DOS devices, slash SQL, and slash Windows. And so the kernel actually looks at things at that level, at kind of the full path level. And as I said, this contains all device entry points. So the C drive's in there, but so is the registry. Is actually is a node in the namespace. TCP is just a device. We've got slash device slash null, which is similar to slash dev slash null. And so the main thing we had to do to be able to have a per container object namespace is to implement a kind of cheroot mechanism within Windows. So essentially, when we start up a container, we say, okay, for this silo, I actually want to have its object namespace root be a subdirectory slash silo slash foo or slash silo slash bar. And then when that silo asks for slash DOS devices slash C colon, they actually get slash silo slash foo slash DOS devices slash C. So I think it's probably easier to see this if we actually go back to the VM here and take a look at the, let's just start up that nano guy again. Actually, wrong one. Start this guy. So I've got a tool here called Objdir. So here I've got my, in this window, I've got my nano server VM here, or nano server container here and back on the root. Objdir is an internal tool that lets me look at this namespace, this directory namespace. It's kind of like dir, except it does it for the object namespace. So if we look here, in the root, there's all sorts of junk. Here's that DOS devices that I mentioned. There's a directory for a file system, so on and so forth. If we look at DOS devices specifically, actually it's a symlink to this global ?? Who knows why that's called that? But so here's all the devices that are actually available to my host. So you can see like the console device is in there. There's various hard disks. So it looks kind of like slash dev, but with a Windows bent on it. So if I go and look in my nano server container, let's look at the same global ?? Wow, much smaller, right? So we've really restricted what this container can see, the devices it can see, to just a few things: the console, the file system, a few networking related things, and that's about it. So only 20 entries instead of 133. But then if we go back out here, as I said, that's really just a, we've got that kind of cheroot mechanism. So this global ?? Should map, for the container, should map to something on the host. So if I look at the silos directory, you can see there's one entry in there, it's 460, that's I think the job ID. And then if we look here, we can look at the silos global ?? And we see, oh, it's the same list. So you can see how it really is just a nested thing. Just like on Linux, where we would, essentially the silo just gets a, or the container gets a subportion of the true global namespace. So that's object namespaces. Briefly talk about a file system, because I think this is a particularly tricky part for us. Just like how Windows Server Core has to be huge because there's all these interdependencies and apps have taken dependencies on a lot of different Windows functionality over the years, the same is true for our file system. NTFS has kind of grown and grown. We've added feature after feature to it. And Windows applications really have come to depend on those features. So we've got things like transactions, file IDs, USN journals, there's object IDs. I don't know, there's a bunch of stuff I don't really understand. And it's difficult to build a true union file system while preserving all these semantics, because for each of these features, you really have to re-implement it with kind of the union file system in mind. So at least for V1 of the Windows Server containers, we've taken what I consider kind of a hybrid model, where we said, well, we really want as many features of NTFS as we can get, but we still want to be able to have we don't want to have like a full block device. We don't want to use like a dev mapper type approach where we're taking block level snapshots of the container file system. So we know that has some performance problems and things. So we took this hybrid model where we do have a virtual disk per container. We do actually have a full NTFS file system per container. But the files in there actually are backed, are essentially symlinks. They're called reparse points. But they're kind of like symlinks back to the host file system. And what this means is that when you start up, you've got this small NTFS partition. There's really nothing in it but a little bit of file metadata that says, oh, just look over here for the actual files. And then as you write files, as you change files, they actually get persisted into that virtual block device. And when we commit a layer, we have to pull them back out. But this hybrid model works pretty well for us. You know, it's something we'll probably continue to evolve after V1. But this is where we are for now. By comparison, the registry, and here I mean the Windows registry, is, you know, there's obviously other registries out there that some people may be interested in. You know, the registry is another kind of very unique thing to Windows, I think, and because it's global. The kernel uses it. You know, any service can just reach out and use the registry. It's really another file system. It's really a small file system. The good news is it's much simpler than NTFS. At least its contract is much simpler. And so for that, we actually did build a true union file system for the registry. And so even though we could have just said, no, the registry, you know, registry hives in Windows are just files. So we could have just allowed the file system to kind of do copy and write for those, just like we did do for all the other files. But we said, well, actually, the registry is important enough to be efficient, and it gets used all the time, so every layer would have its own full copy of the registry if we did that. So we built actually a union file system there. And so I think this is kind of an interesting point where we really had to think hard about how do we make sure, you know, how do we do something like that while making not requiring Docker to know what the heck a Windows registry is, because you wouldn't really want to have that kind of pollute the Docker code. And so as a result, we found a way to do this while kind of hiding that fact from Docker. But if you were to use Docker and you were to look at, if you did like a Docker diff to see what files have changed, I think you might actually see the registry hive show up there as kind of a special case. So I don't know. I found that kind of interesting. OK, so that's kind of all I want to talk about with Windows Server containers. And I want to shift to what we call Hyper-V containers. And this is something that maybe you haven't heard as much about or you haven't played with yet, because it's a little bit different from what Docker offers on Linux. And the problem we kind of had is that you know, we find that some workloads need a little bit more isolation than you get with just containers with a shared kernel. You know, there are some workloads where you might still use a VM because you know, you're worried about hostile multi-tenancy and elevation of privilege attacks, or you're under some regulations with your workload that you have to run them in a VM or something like that. And it'd be a shame if you had to always go back to a VM for that, even if your workload was otherwise very well suited to running in containers. And so what we've come up with is that, well, why don't we just run the containers inside a VM, but not the whole Docker thing, but run each container in its own independent VM. And let's try to do that as transparently as possible so that the user doesn't even really know the difference. It's not another VM you have to manage. There's no state associated with this VM. It's just another flag to Docker that says, oh, for this container, I want to run it inside of a Hyper-V VM. So that's what we did. Docker. With few exceptions, Docker doesn't really even have to know about this other than passing a flag down to that compute service I mentioned earlier. And in fact, this is the default. If you run on Windows 10 as opposed to Windows Server, if you're running on a client machine, Hyper-V containers are the default because we actually, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's this tight interdependency of Windows. We can't actually run Windows Server containers on a client machine because the versions end up being different and we get these conflicts in the kind of the kernel mode user mode interface. With Hyper-V containers, it's not a problem because the VM we're running is a very small Windows Server container. So on Windows 10, So that you can run Windows Server containers, we actually made Hyper-V containers the default. And the great thing about this then is, because it's just transparent, the images are identical. So there's no VM state that gets persisted in the container image or anything like that. Your container doesn't even really know about that. It just looks exactly the same inside the container. It's really just a difference in how we're running it. So if we go back to this earlier slide of, okay, well, this is the way Windows Server containers look. Compare that to the Hyper-V containers, where instead of having a single shared kernel at the bottom, we have a single shared hypervisor, and we have multiple Windows kernels. And then you can see in the green box on the right, we have this, what we call Hyper-V container. It's got a few basic services running, and then inside of that, we've got a full Windows Server container. So that Windows Server container is the same one that you see out here. Everything's the same about it. And this seems kind of crazy, right? So how do we do this? Because you know, if you do this, it seems like, okay, it's going to take a long time to start, and it's going to use a lot of memory. And shared kernel's better, right? Well, we went through a lot of work to try to make to minimize that extra overhead of having this additional VM for every single container, right? Some people said, well, why don't you just pack multiple containers into one VM? I said, no, let's see how far we can go with just a VM per container. So the first thing we did is we said, well, the VM needs to be, the VM image, you know, we've got some like Windows stuff that's running in there, right? We need to make that as small as possible. And so we made a special kind of distribution of Windows that is very small. Is it the smallest one yet? Not really. No. There is a smaller Windows out there. But you know, we have only kind of the services and the kernel configuration and things that we need to be able to run a container. And then, like I said, that VM stateless. When you stop the container, we throw away anything that thing might have persisted into its registry or whatever. So there's we don't have to keep a bunch of extra state on disk around for this thing. The second thing we had to figure out is, okay, well, if you're running this container in a VM, you still want it to hook up to the I/O subsystems in the same way that it did when it was running with a shared kernel. You still wanted people to access files on the host file system without having to like make an extra block device to assign stuff in or anything like that. So for that, we actually use SMB. That's the Windows File Sharing Protocol. We use SMB to share portions of the host file system into the utility VM, as I call it, into the Hyper-V container VM. And we do this as efficiently as we can. We use our VM bus transport. We don't do this over networking like you might for normal SMB, but we do this over VM bus, which is, if you're familiar with the KVM, this is kind of our VirtIO equivalent. And I think the coolest thing we do with that is if you run, let's say you're running a program inside your container. Let's say you're running Notepad. I don't know why you would do that. But and you've got another container. And you've got maybe a whole, a bunch of containers that all want to run Notepad. Well, it would be a shame if we had to have duplicate memory. We'd have to use physical memory for each copy a Notepad. With regular containers, we don't have to. We can actually share the file cache for those. But with VMs, you'd think, okay, well, each VM has like 4 gigs or whatever apportioned to it, and we just have to use some of that memory for each container. Well, actually, no. We've got this because we're using SMB in this way, because all the files come over from the host, and we're just mounting portions of the host file system into the VM. We can actually physically map portions of the or these executables into the VMs in a way that we can run directly from the host file cache. So we get this file cache sharing that really helps us keep our density high for being able to run multiple of these VMs side by side on a single machine. And then finally, networking. I mentioned we've got to get our I/O in there. Networking is just a virtual NIC, just like any VM. And actually, I didn't mention it before, but that's essentially how it works even for the shared kernel case. But even that wasn't enough. You know, we ran that, and it took like 40 seconds to boot the thing and used a bunch of RAM. And that was pretty early. We knew there was a lot of work to do. But we said, well, what else can we do? So we've developed this cloning functionality. So briefly, go back. If you look at this picture one more time, you can see the Hyper-V container there in green doesn't have any container-specific stuff in it. There's no if you take that Windows Server container piece out, it's the same every time. Every time you launch a container, we first start up that green part, and then later we inject in the Windows Server container. So why do we start that up multiple times? So with cloning, let's just launch this VM, this utility VM, once, and then let's freeze its memory state. So we get everything up, we get all the kernel state that we want, we start up a few processes that we need, and then we just pause the virtual processors in that VM, and we leave that thing running. And then whenever you want to start an actual container, a Windows Server container with in Hyper-V mode, with isolation Hyper-V, we just fork that VM. I mean, very similar to forking a process in Linux. We fork the memory state of that VM and share that memory state for each new copy in kind of a copy-on-write fashion. What this means is that startup time of starting up the VM is pretty much gone. And we get much better density because there's a bunch of kind of immutable kernel state that we really don't need to have multiple copies of if it's never going to change or it's going to change very rarely. So so let's see a quick demo of this. Again, this is all kind of transparent to the user. So let's just see what that looks like. So first thing I want to do, let's get out of this nano server guy. So let's run, first let's just run our demo VM with isolation equals Hyper-V. You can see this first time it takes a little bit of time. And we're getting this better. This is not kind of we'll probably be faster by the time we actually ship this thing. But OK, great. So we've run a container once. And if you noticed, if you look at what's going on in Task Manager here, now we've got these weird nameless processes. What the heck is that?
We're fixing that.
Yeah. When I left, I went on vacation 3 weeks ago. I just got back. And they told me they were going to fix that. But it hasn't happened yet. So we've got these nameless processes. These actually represent that template that I talked about. So we actually started a template, and then we ran the thing. So if I run this again, it'll be faster. Now, it's not going to be super fast, because there's a bug that we didn't get fixed in time for this build. But it is faster, as you can see. And so the template's still there. If you were watching the screen, you might have seen a small change where we started yet another process, and then it exited. And so I will just do that now. Let's just run this interactively real quick, so we can look a little more closely. We can see, okay, now we've started actually a third thing. And here's this thing's private bytes are going up because we are using some memory to launch all those Windows processes. So this is kind of the memory for the container. If we scroll down, there's these two VMWP. These are worker processes. If you've ever used Hyper-V in the past, you might be familiar with these. Each VM has a process running on the host. So we've got two of those as well, one for the template and one for this guy. But otherwise, this thing's actually the same. So if you know, we can go back and run objdir again. It's the same 20 entries. This behaves exactly the same as it did when we were running without that isolation mode. It was just regular Windows Server containers.
So, sorry, if you run the Linux OS?
Do you mean like Linux containers like this? Not yet. We can talk about that more. Actually, yes. So that is the end. So great question. Thank you. So I think the first question was really about, okay, well, we've got this cool VM technology. Can we do something with Linux? And I'm going to let Taylor give the political answer first.
So I would say architecturally and technically, yeah, it's something we could implement. It's something we're thinking about. We're actually looking for feedback. So the first question we always have to ask when we think about these things is, should we do it? Just because we can doesn't necessarily mean we should, right? That's the answer I'm generally getting is, yes, we'd like it. More feedback that I get that says, yeah, the more I can put pressure on these guys to go do the work to do it. You know, but it's a question, are we, you know, are people going to use that? Do they want to run a Linux container on top of Windows? Sounds like the answer, yes, from over here. More? Yeah? All right.
Yeah. My answer is just, man, that sounds like a lot of fun. I hope they let me do it.
Hey, yeah, I was just going to ask, you mentioned compute service is going to be a public API?
Yeah. The compute service, yeah. It is going to be public. So I mentioned those two GitHub locations for some language bindings today. That's the extent of the documentation right now. That will change. Eventually, we'll have this stuff up on MSDN, I think, most likely.
It'll be on docs. Eventually, it'll be docs.microsoft.com.
Oh,
all of the Microsoft documentation over the next decade or however long it's going to take us to do it is going to move to docs.microsoft.com.
Hello. Just a question on the TP5 and the new incoming version. When do you plan to implement the overlay driver, especially about the SWAM, because we are popping some SWAM into Windows TP5, and we are ensuring the issue. We are getting some issues with the driver overlay for the network, and we really need it. So just a question from Microsoft.
So I'm trying to make sure I understood you. So the question was, when are we going to have swarm capability for TP5? So we've got an alpha right now that the Docker folks have been working on primarily. So we've been really focused on just getting the engine part of it up. Swarm and Compose are things we'd actually like to pay more attention to, but just getting all this engine stuff has been a lot. If you're seeing problems with it, please submit some feedback on the forum so we can try to help get it working. But it's part of the goal, yeah.
We have time for one last question over there.
Run. Get a workout.
Thanks. Just to return briefly to the Linux in a VM on Windows, Linux containers in a VM on Windows, maybe I'm confused, but isn't, you said at the beginning, this is not Docker for Windows. Isn't that what Docker for Windows is, but Linux containers in a VM on Windows, and how would this be different?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at some of the technology going into Docker for Windows, which does do that, I think there's probably some technology we could share if we go down that path. The approach they've taken is a little bit different, where they run multiple containers in a single VM, and they're actually running, they're kind of forwarding Docker commands. Docker's actually running inside that VM, and then they're forwarding things. I think that this has some advantages and disadvantages. With the kind of VM per container approach, we get better isolation, and then,
we get clone.
We get clone, that's true. But I mean,
we get file cache sharing and a single file space. So there's a few,
I think the level of integration is tighter with our solution, but it's kind of a longer path to making it work really well.
Thank you. Okay, one last after last question.
And we'll be around tomorrow all day.
Or even after for a few minutes.
If you have familiarity with a Docker file on Linux today, what types of things can I expect coming to, you know, use Windows Docker containers? What types of things are not going to be supported in a V1?
So the easy answer is anything that's kind of Linux specific. So like there's Docker run for like LXC options. Well, we don't have LXC. It's a different thing. The harder one is there's just things that are going to be harder for us to get working all the way. So I don't think it's that they won't ever work. They may not work in the first version. So for example, we're just making top work right now. And that actually required some changes in the platform level to get that to work all the way.
Cool. I didn't know we were doing that.
Yeah.
Great.
We just approved the bug.
Yeah. And I mean, actually, that's maybe an important point is if you've tried it and there are things that don't work, like Docker features that just say, oh, it's not supported in Windows or whatever, let us know that those are important to you because we don't have much time left for this V1 to be able to get these working. You can reach out to us or to John Howard, the maintainer for the Docker work.
frankly, for a lot of those, filing a GitHub issue on Docker and tagging it with Windows is a really useful way for us to triage those.
Absolutely.
Thanks. One last round of applause for them.
Thank you.